Hey, everybody. Matt Regan at WealthCare. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to turn the tables a little bit on our advisor spotlight. As everybody knows who has listened to our advisor spotlight, Russ Thornton typically does the heavy lifting and interviews. And we're going to turn things around today, and I'm going to interview Russ a little bit and find out a bit about Russ, his practice, what he focuses on, and hopefully take a deep dive on one of our great friends and great WealthCare advisors, because I think there's a lot to learn here, not just about Russ and his practice, but about what he does in a specific niche. So Russ, welcome. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for being willing to get into the dentist chair here. It's good to have you.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Looking forward to the conversation today.
So I think I'll steal some of your questions because I've listened to all your advisor spotlights and they've been great. And then I'll throw in some of my own. So why don't you just start telling us a little bit about yourself, about Russ the person.
Yeah, sure. So as Matt mentioned, I'm Russ Thornton. I am a financial advisor based in Atlanta. I've been doing this since, I'm almost having a hard time remembering when I started, but I've been at it for close to 30 years now. So I started right out of college, joined Merrill Lynch as a broker trainee here in the Atlanta area. Wound up surviving, which is probably the best word to describe my Merrill Lynch experience. I had a good experience at Merrill Lynch, all things considered, but it's very much a game of attrition, especially when you're young. So I survived, spent about a dozen years there, left in the 2006 timeframe. After doing a lot of research and due diligence and soul searching, decided to drop my securities licenses and become a fee-only advisor. So I set up my own RIA here in Atlanta at the time, and it was literally just me. So I was doing everything from soup to nuts, for better or worse. And I quickly learned that I loved the independence and the autonomy in the agency. I did not so much relish the business of running the business. So while I'm fascinated by how advisors work and operate in the different ways to serve clients, and I find that endlessly fascinating, I didn't really enjoy the bookkeeping and the kind of back office stuff that, and compliance, which is just, such a necessity, given the regulated world that we operate within. So in the 08, 09 timeframe, I reconnected with the folks at WealthCare. I had used what was then called Financeware, what's now called GDX 360. I had used that off and on, even during my time at Merrill Lynch, as a planning and a portfolio tool. So I'm not even sure how it happened, but I reconnected with the folks at WealthCare and started a dialogue. And around that time, WealthCare had primarily been a technology provider to financial advisors and financial institutions and enterprises. Right before I reconnected with them, they had launched their own RIA and started offering portfolio management and outsourced planning solutions to advisors. And I'm not sure about this, but I think I was maybe one of the first five advisors to start working with them in that capacity. So I did it on a selective basis, kept my RIA, kept my own entity, and used them as a third-party outsourced provider. Long story short, it worked really well for me. I was delivering better advice and a better experience to my clients. And so in the late 09, I just pulled the trigger, basically merged my RIA into WealthCare, became an employee advisor of WealthCare's RIA. And here we are, however many years later, 12, 13 years later, and it's been a great partnership.
Great. Take me back a little bit to the Merrill Lynch days, because I'm unfamiliar with that in my career. What's the real difference between what you were doing then and what you do now as a fee-only advisor?
Well, that's a big question. There was a couple of phases of my Merrill Lynch career. I mean, when I started, literally fresh out of college, wet behind the ears. I was literally, it was me in basically a phone book. Thankfully the do not call list was not a thing back then. So I literally spent hours, not even hours. I spent for the first few weeks, you spend about half your day studying for the Series 7 and the Series 63 and your insurance licensing tests. But the rest of the time, you're basically cold calling people, interrupting them during their you would typically call business owners during the day, or this is what I did. You'd typically call people at home in the evening and interrupt them during dinner or whatever. And the general pitch at the time was, are you familiar with Georgia municipal tax-free bonds? So it was a tax-free income pitch. This was the early 90s. I don't remember exactly where interest rates were in the grand scheme of things, but they were much higher than they are now. And you were just trying to, you know, garner some level of interest from the stranger that you're calling and interrupting their day to see if they would be willing to carry on the conversation further, either another phone call or perhaps a meeting.
Yeah.
So I think my target when I first started was, I want to say it was 200, I think it was two or 250 dials a day. And that's like getting hung up on, which happened a lot, or getting a voicemail didn't count. So it was more or less getting, you know, 250 attempts at a conversation a day. It was brutal. And I quickly, I learned, as many probably wouldn't be surprised, I didn't really, you know, savor the joys of cold calling. And I don't know that I really ever developed a thick skin for it either, as some of my colleagues at the time did. But through, I guess, just, you know, persistence, I, you know, got some clients. And at the time, I was pretty much ignorant of the financial planning world, which in many respects was sort of in its infancy compared to where it is today. I think much of the financial planning was really more of a portfolio proposal, an elaborate portfolio proposal disguised as a, you know, financial plan. All that being said, so I was not really thinking holistically about the client. I was really like, hey, if you've got two nickels to rub together, you can fog a mirror and you're willing to talk to me, then, you know, by God, I'm going to get my car, drive, you know, across Atlanta, fight traffic and come see if I can sell you a tax-free bond or mutual fund or frankly, whatever you would buy. You know, it's really, I wasn't kidding. It was kind of a game of survival at that point. Fast forward a few years, I had gotten a few clients that had begun to entrust me with more and more of their financial resources, portfolio, et cetera. This was probably 6 or 8 years into my Merrill Lynch experience. And I started to have a couple of realizations. The first of which it was that I was not a very good stock picker. Thankfully, I didn't blow up anyone during the process, but it's just something that, you know, it was not something that I had a natural affinity for. And I doing some reading research and things like that, I quickly discovered that, you know, very few people have that, you know, natural talent or at least persistence of that talent over time. So that led me to looking at things like index funds and diversification and what I think many people would now consider as kind of more fundamental portfolio management approaches. I also began to discover financial planning through Merrill Lynch's pushes into that world. So they had some internal financial planning tools and services, which in hindsight weren't that great, but frankly, they were probably better than anything I was attempting to do up to that point. Yeah, so the combination of discovering what I consider a better way to invest and a better way to deliver advice in the context of a financial plan that doesn't just look at their portfolio, but really looks more at the totality of their life and what's the money for, what are they trying to accomplish? How much risk are they willing to take versus how much money can we attempt to make you, which was kind of my philosophy up to that point. It kind of opened this whole new world of, you know, there's a lot of different people out there doing things different ways. I could go on, but hopefully that gives you a little bit of a flavor for my evolution as an advisor.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting that, you know, at a certain point, and it was, you know, it was concurrent with what was going on in the industry, this notion of planning, just kind of the light went on, right? Like that's what we should be doing. you know, I worked for an RIA before I joined WealthCare that went back to about 86. That's when they started. And, you know, they were doing planning with a time clock. You know, you hit the clock and then you sent out a bill, and it was much more of a almost like a legal, you know, business model. But again, during the time period when you were at Merrill Lynch, that's when everything changed, right? And people started to think much more about, you know, the plan being the center of the conversation.
In hindsight, a lot of this stuff, you know, comes into much more clarity, but yeah, it was, I consider myself lucky to have gotten into the profession when I did, and to have kind of been able to, ultimately kind of ride the wave of, you know, moving from picking individual stocks and investments to more of a, fee-based portfolio management-based approach to investing. And then, you know, that hand in hand with more holistic planning-based advice, which is less based on, you know, how is our last investment recommendation done? What have you done for me lately? And it's more like, you know, what's the life we're trying to build for you, right, Mr. and or Mrs. Client, and how can we best go about that? So, I consider myself lucky in many respects of having been at the right place at the right time.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, where you've come, you know, which is today WealthCare for Women. You've established a niche that you, excel in. What was the movement towards that? How did that all happen?
Yeah. Matt, I'd love to tell you that it was this grand, you know, strategy or design, but as with most things in life, I kind of fell into it. Starting back to my early days at Merrill Lynch, I just found myself working with and enjoying working with more and more women. So I'd work with a couple, they'd get up there in age, the husband would pass away. I'd have the opportunity to continue to work with the surviving spouse, or I was getting introduced to more and more women who were either happily married, but, you know, were, you know, very engaged and involved in the family financial decision-making, or they were divorced, or in some cases single and never married. And I discovered a couple of things. I found that my communication style, my approach to advice, what I like to think is a pretty well-developed ability to listen, seems to resonate better, generally speaking, better with women than with a lot of men. And going back to some of the things we were talking about earlier, my shift from investment selection and market timing to, you know, more diversified portfolio management and financial planning seemed to resonate better with women. Again, I'm painting with a pretty broad brush here, but they seem to more appreciate having a strategy and a plan in place as opposed to kind of flying by the seat of your pants and hoping things worked out. Now it's probably been 6, 7, or 8 years ago now. I just kind of embraced it. I said, you know, these are the people I most enjoy working with. These are people that I have a demonstrated track record of being able to help and add value to their lives. I just kind of went all in. And so today, WealthCare, the current iteration of WealthCare for Women didn't start there. It kind of went through a couple of evolutions. But today I work predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly with women. Again, they could be happily married, but they want to be involved and engaged in the family financial decisions. Many of my clients are widows or have gone through divorce. And as a result, I've developed some really good relationships with family law and divorce attorneys, with other professionals like forensic accountants that get involved in the divorce process, with some probate attorneys that deal with people settling maybe a husband's estate, and they recognize that the surviving wife needs some financial help or handholding or guidance. And I can talk much more on this, but the transition of going from, you know, literally the world is your addressable market to narrowing that down to a more deliberate focus on a niche has been a world changer. If for no other reason, because of the fact that it allows me to better focus my time and attention and energy on the people, either directly or indirectly, that I want to build relationships with and try to serve, versus, you know, sitting down at your desk and, for me at least, literally feeling this like feeling of overwhelm of like, all right, well, you know, what do I do today? You know, who do I spend my time and energy and resources on today to try to get some traction? So it's, from that respect, it's been a game changer.
Yeah. You know, from a practice management point of view, it's, you know, it's kind of one of the key, you know, pieces of advice that you get out there in the industry is, man, you should figure something out. You should figure something out that you really enjoy and that you really can focus on, create a niche for yourself. But it's amazing how few advisors actually follow through on that. So yeah. Congratulations on that. And you and I have talked about this a little bit, you know, in the past, but tell us a little bit about the specific challenges for women in wealth management. What are the key issues that make things, you know, oftentimes more challenging for women, and how do you help address those?
Yeah, that's an hour long conversation right there. But to hit on a couple of the highlights, and I think I'm probably stating the obvious for many folks out there that might be listening to this, but you know, there's the wage gap. So women typically earn, you know, anywhere from 65 to 75 or 80 cents on the dollar for comparable work that a man performs. Many women are out of the workforce for a period of years to have children, raise a family. All women statistically are going to outlive men. So they've got to plan for a longer planning horizon or a longer lifetime. I think there's some more nuance around some of those things, but those are the main challenges. It's just, you know, planning for a longer time horizon, a longer lifespan, while at the same time, maybe having less earning opportunities and or choosing to be out of the workforce for, you know, a few years or, you know, a couple of decades to start and raise a family. You know, those aren't insurmountable, but the deck is definitely stacked against many women in that regard.
And when you think about, you know, how you use the WealthCare, you know, platform, you know, GDX 360, the comfort zone, you know, the various elements of our own solution. Are there pieces of that that lend themselves to, you know, being able to have those conversations and address those specific risks?
Yes and no. And this is not a shortcoming of WealthCare or GDX 360, but some of these things are just like big problems that I'm never going to be able to solve or fix.
Right.
But on a more practical level, the WealthCare process does facilitate some much more, I believe, much more meaningful and solutions-based conversations around some of these things. So we can very easily say, you know, out of the box, all things being equal, you know, for a woman today in her, let's say, 50s or 60s, we're going to assume you're going to live to 95. But do you have a family history of health issues or anything like that, that, you know, your parents or grandparents or older relatives live shorter lives or longer lives? Because we can adjust that. And we can very easily and quickly on the fly say, you know, what happens if you live an extra 5 years? Mm-hmm. How does that change your lifestyle? And more importantly, how does that change decisions we need to think about today? Like saving more, working longer, maybe leaving a smaller liquid estate to your children or grandchildren, things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's one example. It also opens the door, I think, to some interesting conversations around, and this is not women specific, but I think many people have maybe find themselves in a career where they're really just, you know, and oftentimes making a ton of money, but they're literally just punching the clock. They don't get a lot of fulfillment or personal rewards from the work they're doing. It's a grind. They're working more and more, which is taking away from the other aspects of their life and their family and things like that. So another interesting conversation to have in the context of a WealthCare plan is, what if you were to transition into something that you would enjoy more and find more fulfilling? Maybe you take a pay cut, but maybe because you enjoy it, it's something you're willing to do longer. So maybe if you were planning to work to 62 or 65, Now, if you find something that you really enjoy, even if it pays a little bit less, maybe it's something you'd be willing to do in your 70s, because now it's not, it doesn't feel so much like work. It feels like something you actually look forward to doing every day. So just making space for those types of conversations and having a tool to help, in my case, help women consider the choices that they have and evaluate the trade-offs among those choices, I think is super, super helpful. And I've been around long enough and seen a lot of other financial planning tools out there. I've not seen anything that holds a candle to what we can do with GDX 360 in the context of the overall wealth care process to help facilitate those conversations.
Yeah, that's great. So you're getting, I'm hearing some actual, you know, client success stories. Is there one, you know, favorite client success story that you would share with us that kind of brings that together?
Yeah, so I've got a couple I could draw from. One that comes to mind, it's actually a married couple that I've been working with now for probably 25 years. If you go back to, this probably would have been about 10 or 12 years ago, the husband and wife were still working. And I think of this story specifically because it really kind of revolves around the wife, but they're both still working full time. Retirement was coming into view, you know, on the horizon. And we were talking about some things, and we had done a wealth care plan for them and had been, you know, monitoring and reviewing that over time. Mm-hmm. And I sat down with them one day. I remember this specifically. I remember their office right off of Mount Vernon in Atlanta. We were sitting in his office with both of them. And I said, hey, we get to have a really cool conversation today because of the fact that you guys have been diligent savers and the market's been doing pretty well. We're now at all of our ideal goals. And so for what that means for those out there listening is in the parlance of wealth care, we look at ideal goals and acceptable goals. Ideal are considered kind of aspirational. Acceptable are considered more like, you know, something you'd still be happy with, but maybe they're a little bit more grounded in reality. This couple over time was now able to achieve all of their ideal aspirational goals. So I said to them, you know, I don't get to have this conversation with clients very often, but it's pretty cool when we do, because now we need to dream up some new goals. We need to kind of, you know, think about what else you'd like to do, because now you can do everything you've ever said you wanted to do and more. And she got a little teary eyed and she's like, well, you know, I'd planned to work another 2 or 3 years, but I'd really like to consider ways I could maybe dial back now, spend more time with my mom, who is, you know, getting up there in years. She's not going to be around much longer, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Long story short, we were able to adjust their plan. Instead of her working another, I want to say it was another 3 or 4 years, we were able to retire her within 12 months. Her husband continued to work a little bit longer, doing some consulting and things like that. She was able to spend a lot of time with her mom, who wound up passing away, I want to say 4 or 5 years later. And so just knowing I had a small role in giving her the ability to spend more time with her mom, who meant so much to her, when previously she didn't think she could. I mean, how cool is that? That's just one small example of the types of stories like that, that I could share with you where.
Yeah. It's funny when I joined WealthCare, I remember I was talking to Lenny Reinhart and he was trying to get me up to speed on, you know, how the wealth care comfort zone approach is different. And, you know, his comment was, you have to understand that these wirehouse advisors are in the business of inflicting, you know, the most possible pain and sacrifice that they possibly can on their clients. So the idea that, you know, your conversation is, hey, we did it. Let's do some other stuff. Let's create some new goals is awesome. That's kind of the power of the system, I think.
It is. And the other thing too, I like about it, I like about the wealth care process is it does not diminish the value of investing in tax planning and estate planning and risk management. But I think it does a really nice job of putting them in context of what, in my estimation, is much more important, which is the life we're trying to give our clients and their families and their children and the grandchildren and the organizations that they care about. And so notice, like in when I was telling that story, it wasn't about their portfolio. It wasn't about, you know, how much money we made them on investment XYZ or how much we saved them in taxes. It was really like, hey, you know, you've done this. And I was very clear about giving them the credit for that. But since you're here, what else can we do? You know, what else, you know, let's think a little bit more broadly and expansively, what else you'd like to do. And it uncovered some things that, you know, maybe wouldn't have surfaced otherwise, which is, I think, pretty neat.
So if I have the timeline right, those clients would have been from your Merrill Lynch days?
Yes, they were. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So one before I switch gears a little bit, you know, you've mentioned a few times about this idea that, hey, I'm not a stock picker. I found a solution to outsource that investment management piece. Outsourcing in general, what, when you think about, you know, non-revenue generating activities like picking a portfolio or compliance, things like that, what's your philosophy or your level of comfort when it comes to outsourcing activities that you know, people would say that's what an advisor does?
That, you know, that really took a mind shift for me, especially kind of cutting my teeth in the wirehouse world, which, again, let me be clear, despite all the stories you hear about the ills of the wirehouse world, I had a really positive experience overall at Merrill Lynch.
Right.
But just coming up in that environment where it's very much like I can even share, like as a rookie, so before, while I was studying to get my licenses, before I could actually start cold calling and bugging people to see if they'd meet with me, one of my responsibilities was every day I would have to literally go into our Quotron system. We didn't even have full PCs at this time. I'd have to go into our Quotron system and print off a muni bond report and make copies and pass that out to all the brokers every day. I would also have to go in and print out the daily production report. And so I would literally, it was a public facing, basically tally of what every broker in the office did the prior day, and then what they'd done month to date, quarter to date, year to date. Mm-hmm. So it was very much a competitive, very sales driven environment. Thinking back to, you know, those days, it was very much like you're kind of responsible for your own success. It's kind of dog eat dog. And I don't think it was ever explicitly said, but I think it was very clearly implied, like, you know, if you're going to survive, if you're going to thrive or do well in this business, it's all on your shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
Implicit to that was, you know, you've got to do everything. You got to sell, you got to do paperwork, you got to follow up, you got to do customer service, you got to do everything. So fast forward to where I'm at today, I'm in a very different place. And it took some time for me to get comfortable with the idea of handing off some of those responsibilities. What I did learn, though, when I left Merrill Lynch and had my own firm is I actually saw firsthand and experienced firsthand all of the work that goes into running, operating, keeping compliant for me at the time, a small RIA. And I realized if I wanted to grow and serve more people and be more helpful to more people over time, you know, to scale some of those things was going to be really difficult to do on my own. Maybe not impossible, but difficult. And so that's, I think, what really pushed me over the edge and got me more comfortable with the idea of outsourcing. I'd already done it, as I mentioned, even back in my Merrill Lynch days, I used Financeware a little bit here and there. You know, so indirectly, that's a form of outsourcing.
And we all
outsource certain aspects of our lives, whether we think about it that way or not. Whether that's having someone mow your lawn or change the oil in your car or whatever the case may be. All that being said, I guess in hindsight, when I think about, and the comment I made earlier, like I love the business and I love, in some respects, I consider myself a student of the business, but I don't like keeping the business running. In my ideal world, I want to spend as much or all of my time interfacing with clients, having conversations like the one I share with you, and then having the opportunity to get introduced to more people that I can hopefully serve. In order for me to do that, I needed to take as much of my non-client facing activities off the table as possible. And I'm happy to share more detail, but that's where I'm at today, thankfully.
Yeah.
And it's a great setup.
And I think what we would say, and I think you've kind of arrived at it, is that's how you really create enterprise value in your practice. By focusing on those most meaningful activities and generating new clients and generating, successful outcomes for your clients. That's where you create the value. I want to switch a little bit because there's a couple other parts, of your practice that are unique. You are a social media, maven. You're a great follow on LinkedIn. I encourage anybody that's listening to follow Russ on LinkedIn because there's a lot of great stuff there. But you use a number of different social media in order to not only share content, but I assume, build your brand and market. Tell me a little bit about that and how you think about the way that you use social media and ultimately what your goals are there.
I think the best way to explain that is to kind of share my fundamental belief, which is today, everything, if it doesn't exist in Google, it doesn't exist. So my belief is that if Matt, someone says, "Hey, Matt, you and your wife should reach out to Russ. He's a good financial advisor. You've mentioned some things that I think he could help you with." What's the first thing you're going to do?
Well, Google.
It's probably going to be pick up the phone and call me or send me an email. You're going to go to Google. And so when you go to Google, what do you find? Well, for many advisors, you find nothing. And that's a function of some advisors can't do anything online, depending on the business structure in which they operate. But for other advisors, you might find a website. You might find a LinkedIn profile. You might find, some other this, that, and the other. So that belief has really, I think, propelled me and a lot of what I do to be somewhat discoverable online, for lack of a better word. Because if someone types in my name in Google, I want them to have a lot of what I call social proof. I want them to know that, I've been doing this a while. B, that I'm consistent, that, what I say over here lines up with what I say over there. And I want them to know that, I'm not just a one trick pony, if you will. So I don't just have a website, but I also interact and share content, interact with other people on platforms like LinkedIn or Twitter or whatever the case may be. So for me, that's really what I enjoy, kind of tinkering around with this stuff, frankly. Mm-hmm. But from a business motivation, that's really what it's at. It's kind of building the social profile so that if someone is referred to me and they do go to Google to kind of see who Russ is and what he's all about, I want to make it very easy for them to A, find me, B, get to know me, and C, have a way to, if they look me up and they're like, yeah, he seems like a good guy, but I'm not ready to call him right now. I want to make it very easy for them to get to know me over time, whether that's signing up for my email newsletter or listening to podcasts or, whatever the case may be. So it's kind of like, it's almost like, to use a baseball analogy, it's almost kind of like building a farm club, where people can, that's actually a pretty flawed analogy, but giving people a way to kind of get to know me over time and reach out to me when they're ready, but keep that line of communication open, even if it's largely one way at that point.
Podcast, newsletter, you got a blog on your website. You pass content through LinkedIn that's, original to that medium. Any words of advice to advisors that are listening to this that say, oh my God, I could never do that. How would you even get started? How much time do you spend on it? What's your thoughts on how other advisors can get over the hump of that sounds really intimidating?
Well, first let me say, I don't think every advisor needs to do it. I know plenty of advisors that are I know plenty of really good advisors that do really wonderful work for their clients and are super successful, and they do little to nothing online. So I'm not saying it's a prerequisite to success, but if you're interested in in doing some content marketing or building up your online profile, I would first recommend that you start with one thing. And that one thing could be LinkedIn, or it could be Twitter, or it could be a blog or a podcast, or it could be shooting YouTube videos. But, you know, don't feel like you have to be everywhere at once. I would pick one thing. And let's say it's LinkedIn. I would pick one thing. I would really build out your profile, make sure that it actually reflects who you are and who it is you want to serve. Instead of like in the, for example, in the title of your LinkedIn profile, instead of saying financial advisor, be more specific. Say like, you know, tell in your profile, like, who do you serve and why do you serve them? To make it much more evident for somebody that this happens to stumble across you, like who you are and whether or not you're relevant to them. One of the benefits of picking a niche, and I think this is related, is not only do you want to be more attractive to the right people, I think just as important is you want to repel the wrong people. We could dive into that and spend more time on that. But I think that can also manifest itself in what you're doing online. So on LinkedIn, I think it's an opportunity to be very, very clear about who you want to serve. That doesn't mean that you can't serve other people. And I'm a testament to that because I still work with happily married couples and men when the situation arises or I'm referred to them. But and then commit to, you know, maybe once a day, actually just start with once a week, just go, you know, block on your calendar, spend 30 minutes, go into LinkedIn and you don't even have to post any original content, just scroll through your feed, find two or three people that you like and you respect and respond to whatever they're posting. So Let's say Matt posts an interesting article on the state of the, you know, financial advisor industry. Well, I might look on that and say, you know, do I have anything to add to that? You know, do I have a perspective that might be complimentary, or it doesn't have to be complimentary. I could actually push back and say, well, hey, that's an interesting article, Matt, but I disagree on this one point and here's why. And you're just, remember, social media is, don't lose sight of the fact that it's social. It all boils down to people and just start a dialogue. So I don't think you have to come up with this grand content marketing scheme or strategy. Just start with one. And maybe it's not LinkedIn, maybe it's something else completely different. If you don't enjoy writing, don't write. Do a podcast, or if you want to write but you don't like writing, record into your phone. Just like record, you know, talk for 10 minutes, and then go find an editor or someone on Fiverr or Upwork, and they can turn out a really nice, well-written, polished blog post or article that you can put on your site or that you could, you know, pitch to journalists. And you can do that pretty cheap. So I think it's just starting small. I think being consistent is really important. So I think you're almost doing yourself more harm than good if you start something and do it once or twice, and then you go 6 months and then do it again. Right. So I would start small, start with a very manageable schedule, and you can always double down and focus more on that if you enjoy it. And if you see yourself getting traction with it.
Yeah, that's really helpful. The other part that, you know, we know about you, is that, you know, you're a little bit of an Inspector Gadget when it comes to the various, you know, tools that are out there to help advisors. You're always bringing us, you know, kind of interesting new, whether it's a risk analysis tool or whether it's a CRM or whether it's, you know, some sort of social media, you know, tool. What's out there these days that you're interested in? How do you, you know, how should advisors think about, you know, using the myriad, you know, solutions that are out in the marketplace?
Yeah. So I really have an affinity for technology and gadgets and tools and things like that, as you mentioned. I always have. And so I think that kind of manifests itself into, you know, what I do and how I serve my clients. I think that technology and tools can be a great way to augment the way that you serve your clients. But I do not for one second believe that technology should ever get between you and your clients. And I think that's an important point, because I think that I heard or read someone say at one time, you know, talking about scalability like trying to scale your business. And you should never try to scale things that detract from your customer or your client experience. Having said that, you know, I think one of the tools that I think is very accessible and pretty easy to learn and set up is a scheduling tool. Mm-hmm. And I think this is particularly helpful to a solo advisor that doesn't have an administrative assistant. But even if you have a team, I think your administrative assistant time is probably spent better elsewhere than playing phone tag and scheduling stuff on your calendar that can be largely automated. So whether you use a tool like Calendly, which is what I use, or Acuity Scheduling or Schedule Once, they all basically do the same thing. And so I've got that set up. It connects to my calendar. So it's literally set up. I don't have to manage it. So it, for those that aren't familiar, it basically reads my calendar. So if it says I've got an appointment on Tuesday at 10 a.m., it knows not to block anything that Tuesday at 10 a.m. In addition, you can set buffers. So you can say like, I don't want to schedule anything within 30 minutes before or after a meeting, because that way you're not overbooking yourself. It also allows you to be very deliberate about how you're spending your time. So for me, with rare exception, I take all my client meetings on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. I keep my Mondays and Fridays open for planning, review work, things like that. And so I've got that set up in my Calendly. So now if somebody wants to meet or it's time for me to schedule a review meeting with someone, I'll just shoot them an email or a text, include the link to my Calendly in there. They click it and they can pick a time that's convenient for them. I just did it this morning, in fact, with a client who had said, hey, let's connect in January to have another review. Well, I sent them a link mm-hmm. to my Calendly and they scheduled it. And that was one email. So it works tremendously well. It's super easy. That's one great example. Another, you know, beyond sort of the table stakes technologies like a good CRM, I'm amazed mm-hmm. by how many advisors don't have a CRM at all, or they use Outlook, which it would be tough to call that a CRM. Another great tool is called a Follow-Up Then. And this one's really neat because it's not an app. It's not a piece of software you download. It works within your email. I think I pay $5 or $6 a month for this. And I probably use it a dozen times a day. Wow. It's the coolest thing. So for example, let's say, Matt, let's say you send me an email about XYZ. If I wanted to, I would reply to you and say, all right, Matt, thanks. I'll follow up on this. I could BCC. So in the blind carbon copy field of my reply to you, I could say 3days@followupthen.com. I send the email, I delete your email from my inbox and I don't have to think about it. And then 3 days, it sends the email back to me that I sent to you. And it just pops it right back up. So now I can almost kind of use that in tandem with my CRM to make sure that stuff doesn't fall through the cracks. And there's a gazillion ways to use this, whether it's for following up on things, whether it's to the example I gave a minute ago about Calendly. So my client in late November said, hey, we're all good, enjoy the holidays, but let's catch up in January to maybe schedule a time to review. So I replied to that email in, I think it was late November, and I said, BCC, January 5th at followupthen.com. So it popped that into my inbox this morning. So I knew I had to reach out to him again and schedule, reach out about scheduling a review meeting. So I sent him an email and included my Calendly link. And so that's how it works. I could go on. It's probably one of my favorite, most high leverage, most affordable tools that I use, like I say, dozens of times a day.
And both of those tools that you described work really well for like a sole practitioner, right? I mean, that's the challenge. You can't spend all your time doing that sort of stuff, because then you'll number one, you'll drop the ball. And number two, you're not spending your time on what's really valuable.
They do. But as I said, I think whether you're a solo practitioner or you've got a team with partners in other advisors and admin staff, you can still benefit from tools like this, because if you're paying your administrative assistant, for example, whatever you're paying, 40, 50 grand a year, would you rather he or she spend her time doing something that's really arguably low level activity like scheduling and something like that, when you could instead automate that, which by the way, clients love it. They reply all the time, like, this is really cool, by the way, that I was able to just click this and get something on your calendar. But my point being is your administrative assistant in that example could then spend his or her time doing more high value activities, whatever they may be. So I would not dismiss tools like this, even if you have a team and a larger practice. I think they still can play an important role in helping everyone spend their time and energy doing the highest level activities they can that contribute to the practice.
Right. Awesome. So I'm going to steal one of your questions because you've been a real mentor to a lot of our wealth care advisors as they've joined us to try to help them to understand, you know, how our process is different and help them to avail themselves and adopt. But what's the Russ Thornton, you know, guidance and advice to somebody that's thinking about getting into this industry? What are your words of advice? What's your thought on the industry as it exists today? How would you talk to a recent college grad about wealth management in general?
So first of all, I consider myself blessed to be in this industry. I think it's one of the greatest vocations in the world. I get to do well by helping others, which is important to me. And hearkening back to a lot of things we've already covered, there's a thousand different ways to operate as a financial advisor. Not just in the firm environment that you work in or the compensation structure, but or the niche you serve. There's no right way or wrong way. But I think there is a best way for you. And when I say you, I'm talking to whoever might be listening to this. And so mm-hmm. the quicker you can figure out who you are, who you want to serve and how you want to serve them, I think is going to serve you really well over your career. So for a younger person that's interested in getting into this or a younger advisor that's just starting their career, I would try to expose yourself to different advisors, different firms, different ways of working and serving clients, and just get a taste of all the ways to do this business. When I started at Merrill Lynch, I didn't know anything other than Merrill Lynch for probably the first 6 or 8 years. I did not know there were financial planning advisors or fee-only advisors or hourly advisors or whatever the case may be. And so I think the more you can expose yourself to different ways of serving clients is great. So whether that's through organizations like the Financial Planning Association or NAPFA or other organizations where you can get together and meet other advisors and learn from them, I think will probably serve you well. And you never know, that could always lead to other opportunities, professional or personal. The other thing I would really underline is that I got into this business thinking it was a numbers and spreadsheets job. Mm-hmm. And clearly that's part of it. But I think that pales in comparison to the fact that this is a psychology job. At the end of the day, no matter how good your advice, no matter how diligent and how impassioned you are about how you're trying to help clients, if they won't take your advice, if they won't implement what it is you want them to do or what you're encouraging them to do, then what's the point? And so I think recognizing and appreciating the fact that there's a lot of psychology, a lot of behavioral science involved that lives between your advice and the client taking action, I think it's hugely important. And there's not a body of knowledge where you can learn it and get that, or you get that, you ever check that off. It's evolving. People continue to evolve. But I think the more that you're willing to accept and dive into that and learn more about that, I think that will put you light years ahead of the average advisor out there that is focused solely on numbers, spreadsheets, calculations. Get comfortable operating in not just the left brain, but also the right brain. Because most people, and I think research bears this out, make emotional decisions and then use logic to rationalize it after the fact. If you start and end with just the logic, you're probably missing out a lot and you're probably doing a disservice to your clients, even if you don't realize it and even if they don't recognize it. So I'd say get really comfortable with the softer skills, asking really good questions, becoming a good listener, which is much easier said than done, will serve you really, really well. And the final thing is always be curious. The great thing about this business is we're dealing with other humans, and other humans are endlessly fascinating. So just be curious, go into it with an attitude of curiosity and wanting to learn, and you will never There's no way you could ever get bored or find yourself in a rut with this kind of work. It's just awesome.
That's great. That feels like a good place to wrap it up. I'll let you off the hook here, but I really appreciate you taking the time and you know, giving us not only, you know, your story, but you know, a little bit about why this industry is so unique and you know, the special you know, approach that you and a lot of different advisors, many wealth care advisors, bring to it. So really appreciate the conversation, Russ. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. This is great. And I feel like we'd probably talk another hour or two without any trouble at all. But and if anyone out there is listening to this, if you want to reach out to me, if you have questions, if you want to discuss any of this, whether it relates to wealth care and GDX 360 or just the business in general, feel welcome to reach out. I'm happy to help however I can. But Matt, this has been great. Thanks again.
Thank you, Russ.